There was a young soldier in boot camp who was being especially targeted by his drill sergeant, who seemed to take great delight in tormenting him. And he was on his case day and night, in his face, screaming, yelling him, giving him all the hard duty, everything he could do to push this kid. It went on and on and on for days and weeks. The sergeant one day got right up in his face and he said, "Yeah," he said, "I know you hate me." The soldier didn't say anything. He said, "In fact, you hate me so much that when I die, you're going to come and spit on my grave, aren't you?" He said, "No, sir. When I get out of the Army, I don't ever want to wait in line again." So this morning, I want to talk to you about waiting. I want to talk to you about waiting on God, which is one of the things that waiting is not something we enjoy doing all the time, most of the time. But it is the essence of trust. The scripture text, it's kind of long, so I didn't put it on the screen, but it's over in the book of 1 Samuel, chapter 13, from the story of King Saul. At verse 5, it's 1 Samuel, chapter 13, if you want to turn and read there. Verse 5 says, "Now the Philistines assembled to fight with Israel, 30,000 chariots." Wow, that's a big number. 30,000 chariots, 6,000 horsemen, and people like the sand which is on the seashore in abundance. And they came up and camped in Michmash, east of Beth-Aven. When the men of Israel saw that they were in a strait, for the people were hard-pressed, then the people hid themselves in caves and thickets and cliffs and cellars and in pits. And also some of the Hebrews crossed the Jordan into the land of Gad and Gilead. But as for Saul, he was still in Gilgal, and all the people followed him trembling. Now he waited 7 days according to the appointed time set by Samuel. But Samuel did not come to Gilgal, and the people were scattering from him. So Saul said, "Bring to me the burnt offering and the peace offerings." And he offered the burnt offering. And as soon as he finished offering the burnt offering, behold, Samuel came. And Saul went out to meet him and to greet him. But Samuel said, "What have you done?" And Saul said, "Because I saw that the people were scattering from me, and that you did not come within the appointed days, and that the Philistines were assembling at Michmash. Therefore I said, 'Now the Philistines will come down against me at Gilgal, and I have not asked the favor of the Lord.' So I forced myself and offered the burnt offering." Now, if you're asking what's the problem with this, the problem is that Saul was the king. He wasn't the priest. He didn't have the right or the authority to offer the offerings. This is an act of presumption, okay? But he said, "I forced myself." Samuel said to Saul, "You have acted foolishly. You have not kept the commandment of the Lord your God, which he commanded you." What was that commandment? The commandment was to wait until Samuel came, and Samuel came, and Samuel offered the burnt offerings. "For now the Lord would have established your kingdom over Israel forever, but now your kingdom shall not endure. The Lord has sought out for himself a man after his own heart." We know that would be David. "And the Lord has appointed him as ruler over his people." I think one of the more difficult things, that maybe a challenge that we have, is having to wait. When God speaks to us, this is the one word we seldom, if ever, want to hear. It really should be one of the easier things to do. I mean, because to wait, you don't have to be talented, you don't have to be good looking, you don't have to be rich, you don't have to be smart, educated, famous, or influential. So what does it require? Well, for some, the immediate answer would be the word patience. And I wouldn't argue with that. You do need patience. It is important. And Scripture tells us that through tribulation, that tribulation works patience. That's one way, but patience is also a fruit of the Spirit. And it's the work of the Spirit. But I think that patience, as important as it is not the foundation for waiting. It is the disposition, of course, the right disposition. It defines the attitude of the heart, the mental, emotional, and spiritual disposition while waiting. But patience means waiting without anxiety, not becoming irritable while waiting. And if you're patient, you'll find that you can wait a little faster. But I think that at its foundation, waiting is really about, the issue is really about trusting. Do we trust Him enough to wait? The text, if you're paying attention, Saul had a serious problem with that. Peter Marshall said, quote, "Teach us, O Lord, the disciplines of patience, for to wait is often harder than to work." This is why patient waiting is often the highest way of doing God's will. Someone has said we must wait for God long, meekly, in the wind and wet, in the thunder and lightning, in the cold and the dark. Wait and He will come. He never comes to those who do not wait. Now the context here is from 1 Samuel 13, is this, that Saul has been crowned, coronated the newly crowned king of Israel. Saul and 2,000 of his men have gathered in Michmash in the hill country of Bethel. That's back in verse 2. Another 1,000 men are with his son Jonathan, and they attacked a Philistine outpost in Gibeah and stirred up a hornet's nest. I'm giving you the condensed version here, okay? And God begins to orchestrate a series of events to test the heart of Saul. And make no mistake about it, that's what this is all about. Can God trust Saul to obey Him and to wait upon Him? Can he trust the heart of the king? Now, in this story, you'll find that Saul immediately faces some opposition. And the first of his problem is that he has external opposition, and that is that he is facing a superior force. It's an overwhelming problem because if you were listening, the Philistines gathered together with 30,000 chariots. How many did Saul have? 2,000. They have 30,000 chariots, 6,000 horses, and an infantry that cannot be counted because it was like the sand on the seashore. And then added to that fact is that Saul and Israel had inferior weaponry. Now, it's not in the text that we read, but in this same chapter down at verse 19, it points out that there were no blacksmiths in Israel, that they actually went over and when they needed something sharpened, they went to the Philistines and paid a fee for them to sharpen their axes, the hoes, the plowshares. And there was not a sword or spear in their hands of his army, only in the hands of Saul and Jonathan. They don't have enough people. I mean, they don't have enough what they need to do the job. They didn't have enough soldiers. The soldiers don't have the right equipment. They are outmatched. They're outgunned. They're outnumbered. But if you understand how God works, you would know that this really wasn't that much of a problem. Because in the hands of a jawbone found on the ground, Samson killed 1,000 Philistines, just one against 1,000. And if you read in chapter 14, Jonathan and his armor bearer whipped 20 Philistines by themselves. And they said this in verse 6, "The Lord is not restrained to work by many or by a few." So the circumstances around us are never greater than the power that's within us. But then they have some internal problems. And the internal problems are threefold. Number one, there is pressure. And that word, that's where you read in there where it says they were hard pressed. That's what it literally means. The word is pressure. It means to squeeze. They're trapped. There's no way to maneuver. And the pressure comes because they can find no solution to their problem. They are seriously outnumbered. They don't have the right equipment. These guys are angry because of what happened at Gibeah. They are there to exact revenge. Their life is in jeopardy. And they can find no solution to the problem, no way to resolve the difficulty. So what does it create? It creates this tension and stress and strain. So they're under a great deal of pressure. Number two, Saul is experiencing something of betrayal. There's a desertion among the people. The people that he has, they're not enough, but a lot of them are leaving him. Hey, if you were listening, some of them were hiding. They're hiding. They're looking for a place to, you know, to get out of sight. Caves or thickets and cellars and pits. Some of them even left the country, went to another zip code. They fled to Gad and Gilead on the east side of the Jordan River. And in chapter 13, verse 2, 2,000 men with Saul. In 14 and verse 2, there's just 600 men with Saul. So he lost 1,400 members. And the sense of betrayal that Saul must have felt probably can't be described in words. And then the third problem is that with the people who are still with him, there is fear. Those who remain behind, they are terrified. The Bible says they followed him trembling. And you can understand why. So in all of this, you see the problem is, what was it that God wanted from Saul? What did God want Saul to do? He didn't want Saul to climb through the mountains or search in the caves for deserters, you know, and twist their arm and coerce them to come back. He didn't want him to cross the Jordan and round up all the strays. He didn't want him to open a chain of blacksmith shop or import high-tech weapons from neighboring countries. And he didn't want to bring in Bob Hope and the USO to rally or boost the morale of the troops. And the younger people in the audience here have no clue what I just said. He just wanted one thing. Just one thing. All he wanted Saul to do was to wait for him. Just wait. In verse 8, we learned that through Samuel the prophet, God instructed him to wait 7 days. And that was all that was required. He doesn't have to be concerned about the size of the army. He doesn't have to be concerned about the condition of his equipment. He doesn't have to be concerned about the morale or the people who are betraying him. All he has to do is wait, which he found impossible to do. Because Samuel didn't come in the time that Saul thought he should have, and panic set in. And when you feel like, and you get afraid, that time is running out, and we had an old guy in our church in Florida, blessed old man, loved him to death. His name was A.W. Minger. And one of his favorite sayings, he would stop and he'd shake his head and he'd say, I tell you right now, something have got to be did. Have got, not even has got to be did. Something have got to be did. And he's looking at all of this, and that's what Saul, I'm out of time, something have got to be did. And so he makes a mistake. Can I tell you, that's how Ishmaels are born? You remember God promised Abraham he'd give him a son, and now he's 100 years old. And he's waiting and waiting and waiting and waiting, and there's no child, so he kind of takes matters into his own hands, has a child with his concubine, and Ishmael is now born. And guess what? When you run ahead of God like that and give birth to an Ishmael, guess who's responsible for feeding him and clothing him and diapering him and taking care of him? You are. And do you realize that the conflict between Ishmael and Isaac that started back then is still raging in the Middle East to this very day? You can trace the origin of that all the way back to the two nations that would come from those, all because Abraham panicked. And he couldn't wait and trust God's timing. So for 7 days, he had waited and watched his troops desert him. For 7 days, he had lived with the pressure of massive military buildup on his border. And don't you know that every day that pressure became a little greater and a little more intense. That screws were tightened tighter and tighter. For 7 days, he had wrestled with his problem, searching for a solution and finding none. For 7 days, he had tossed and turned in sleepless nights of anxiety and fear. And for 7 days, he had listened to the fearful, defeated voices of those around him who were rehearsing their fear. And for 7 days, he had watched his support dwindle and his friends abandon him. And finally, Saul said, time's up. I've got to do something. Enough of this waiting. The people are scattering. The people are abandoning me. And in a desperate act of arrogance and impudence, He demonstrated a contemptuous disregard for the Lord by running ahead and offering the burnt offering and sacrifice, the offering himself. And I repeat that was not the prerogative of the king. Only the priest could do this. Only the priest. He had absolutely no right to offer the sacrifice. And the moment he has finished offering those sacrifices, well, guess who shows up? You don't have to guess because we read it. Samuel the prophet, verse 10 said, as soon as he finished offering the offering, Samuel came. Saul's deadline had passed, but there was still time left on God's clock. And Samuel came within the appointed time. And he asked in verse 12, what have you done? And in verse 12, Saul makes three excuses. He said, the people were scattering. Mm-hmm. You didn't come. Like, don't you hear a little note of blame right there? This is kind of your fault. You didn't come on time. He's kind of passing the... Look, notice how he's passing the buck to everybody. The people are scattering. You didn't come. The Philistines are threatening. This is everybody's problem but his. So he says, I love it. He says, I forced myself. I made myself do it, and I offered the burnt offerings. So he jumps the gun. He runs ahead of God. He takes illegitimate action. And Samuel says to him, you've acted very foolishly. You have not obeyed the commandment of the Lord. And when things are deteriorating within and problems are increasing without, and when God's timing seems too slow, is when we are most prone to do something foolish. And if you look at verse 13, Samuel said, if you had obeyed, this was the critical test. You failed it, but if you had obeyed, the kingdom would have been established. That word means to stand tall, to stand erect. Would have been established to you forever, but now your kingdom shall not endure. You see, this was never about the size of the Philistine army. It was about the size of Saul's faith and trust. It wasn't about the lack of weapons. It was about Saul's lack of trust and obedience. It wasn't about the people who were scattering. It was about Saul's heart that was wavering. God's eyes weren't on the chariots or the horses, not on the deserters who fled in fear, the faithful few who followed in fear. God's eyes weren't on the problem or the pressure. God wasn't watching to see if the people would be loyal to Saul. He was watching to see if Saul would be loyal to him. And in that moment, the kingdom slipped through his fingers. God would not entrust the responsibility of leading his people to a man who would not trust him, and a man who did not trust him enough to wait under pressure. I don't think that anybody is ever really established in the kingdom of God until we learn this lesson of what it means to wait upon the Lord. And to stand tall in the kingdom, you have to trust him enough to wait patiently upon him. It is the essence of trust. The essence of trust. The essence of trust. Now, I think there are Saul's excuses. I've already run through those. I skipped this on the thing. The people were scattering. Let me run through those. You didn't come. He looked around. But I want to show you two important key points here. One is that Saul valued working over waiting. And we do that. We have a lot of problems with it. It's almost like people feel guilty if they wait. You know, I need to be doing something. And here I am, I'm just waiting. Well, at the time we talked to you about waiting, waiting is more than just sitting around doing nothing. Waiting is a kind of another word for serving. You remember when you go to the restaurant, they used to say your waiter will be with you. Now they say your server will be with you. Waiting and serving, but that's another message. But he attached greater importance. And in this case, the work, nothing wrong with the work. It wasn't sinful. It wasn't something that was ungodly. It was actually something that was good. The work that he was doing, sacrificing was worship. Do you understand? When he talks about worship, sacrificing the burnt offerings and the sacrificial offerings, that was an act of worship. It was an act of worship. And he actually placed more attention to that and didn't realize that the greater act of worship was not as the lambs he brought, but the confidence that he would have in God to trust him and wait upon him and wait for Saul, or rather Samuel, to come. You remember, he had a problem with this when he was sent to destroy the Amalekites and the king, and he was supposed to kill Agag, and he was given strict instructions that he wasn't to spare anybody, but he spared the king and he spared the sheep, remember? And he brought them back, and he said to Samuel, "Behold, I've obeyed the commandment of the Lord." And about that time, a little sheep bleated and exposed him to be a liar, kind of like the... Isn't it amazing how the animal kingdom can rebuke us? Remember the donkey that spoke to rebuke Balaam in the Old Testament, and the rooster that crowed to remind Peter of his disobedience and his sin? And here, and that's what Samuel said. "Oh, you've obeyed the Lord. Huh? What's this lowing and bleating and the sound of sheep that I hear?" What did Saul say? He said, "I spared them for sacrifice. And I spared them for worship." That's what sacrifice was in the Old Testament. And what did Samuel say to him? "To obey is better than sacrifice." And in that context, the word sacrifice is it the idea of you sacrificing something or giving up something. Sacrifice there is synonymous with worship. If worship isn't coming from an obedient heart, it isn't received. It really isn't worship. More important would be that you would obey me, that you would serve. You remember what Jesus said when the devil tempted him to bow down and worship him? He said, "It is written, you shall worship the Lord your God, and him only shall you serve." Service is an act of worship, you see? And in this case, it's divorced from obedience. And so this is what he does. He is valuing work. And a lot of times it's like, "Well, you know, I can't just sit here. I've got to be doing something." And you notice he talked to himself, his self-talk. Did you read it in the text? He said, "I said, the people are scattering." He gave this explanation to Samuel. "I said," meaning to himself, "the people are scattering and I haven't offered the sacrifice." You know, your self-talk is real important. It's real important. And I think probably everybody, whether we admit it or not, we all talk to ourselves a little bit. I do it a lot. Especially right now because Benita's gone in Colorado. And I'm just walking around the house talking to myself because the house is empty, okay? And by the way, if you were ever thinking about having me over to eat, this would be a real good time. Shameless plug right there, I know. But I'm a terrible cook. And somebody said, "I talk to myself because every now and then I need to have a conversation with an intelligent person." I guess you're okay if you just you're not answering yourself. But self-talk, whether it's spoken aloud or just thought, is really important how we talk to ourselves. And I said, he is more concerned with what he said than with what God had said. And God isn't impressed with that. He isn't impressed with that offering. What he wanted was a heart that could rest in him. He didn't want another lamb, another ram. Thousands of those were offered to him. What he wanted was a man to trust him and rest in his word. And the irony of this, He rushes ahead of God under the misguided notion that God is more pleased with his busyness than with his trust. But God takes greater delight in a trusting heart than in a burnt offering. So what happens? The problem gets bigger and bigger, and when you panic, the problem always looks larger than what they are, don't they? And then you become fearful. And this is true. When you become fearful, we almost always exaggerate the situation around us and imagine it to be worse than what it is. And you can't adequately meet all the demands you're facing. You don't have enough of what it takes. You don't have enough time, money, people, energy, passion. You don't have enough help. And you're caught in the vice of pressure, being squeezed from every side, hard-pressed. As they were trapped in circumstances, support begins to erode. People that you've counted on maybe have let you down. They said they'd stand with you through thick and thin, but when things got thick, they thinned out. You feel alone and abandoned. Everything seems to be falling apart. You're losing control of the situation. Everything's going down the tube. And it's the seventh day and God still hasn't showed up. Well, you do. He doesn't want you to rush ahead and offer up a burnt offering. He doesn't want some frantic, frenzied attempt on your part or mine to fix things. He wants us to be still and know that He is God and trust Him enough simply to wait at a time when it is difficult to wait because we trust Him. If you want to prove anything to Him, prove that you trust Him enough to wait for Him. The second point that comes to mind is the fact that Saul almost made it. Do you realize how close he was when he failed? He almost waited. He had waited for 6 days and most of the seventh. And I think, oh, think about this for a minute. His kingdom is in the balance here. Because he failed this test, he loses the kingdom. I want you to think about this for a minute. If only he had waited 30 minutes more, his whole life would have been different. If only he had waited. Another half hour and the kingdom would have been established in his hand. Do you know the largest vein of gold ever found in the United States was found 3 feet away from where a previous crew had stopped digging? Susanna Wesley, mother of John and Charles, was a blessed and patient mother. They had a lot of children. Her husband said to her one time, "I marvel at your patience. You've told and explained this to that child about 20 different times." And Susanna looked fondly at the child and said, "Had I stopped after 19 times, I would have lost all my labor." So how long have you been waiting? You're going to throw all of that away at the end? Just before the answer comes? Just before God breaks through? I like what Ralph Waldo Emerson said. He said, "A man is not a hero because he's braver than anyone else, but because he's braver 10 minutes longer." Can I tell you again, as I've done before, the hardest part of faith is the last half hour. In the storm that night on the Sea of Galilee, when did Jesus come to them? He came in the fourth watch, the last watch, the last hour of the night. He came to them. So he says, the kingdom will be given to another. And God do just the man. That was David, of course. Actually, he was more of a boy at the time. But eventually, he would become Israel's greatest king. And like Saul, if you read the story, I don't have time to pull it up and read it to you from today, but you can find it in 2 Samuel 5. When David was coronated king and became the king, he was tested in the very same way to see if he would trust God and wait for Him. Because in 2 Samuel 5, it records the story of David and his army, the same army the Philistines have gathered. And David doesn't move. He doesn't do anything until he goes and waits and seeks counsel from the Lord. He goes and asks God, "Do I go up against them?" And the Lord spoke to him and said, "Go up, for I've given them into your hands." And on those marching orders, he obeys what God has said and goes against the Philistines, and they are routed and defeated. And while the Israelites celebrate their victory, the Philistines are regrouping and preparing for a counterattack. And they gather a second time to come. They're testing this new king just to see what he's made of. And they come again. This time they kind of circle around and they're going to try maybe to come into, you know, to get the flank and come in from the side. And David does an amazing thing. The second time, he doesn't just assume, "Well, you know, God gave us the victory the first time over them, so we'll just go up against them." He doesn't do that. The Bible said that he went again to ask the Lord counsel, "Do I go up against them?" And this time God said no. Isn't that amazing? We would have just adopted battle plan A the first time around and used the same battle plan the second time. That's what we do. We get a pattern. This is how we do it. Now we know how to do it. And so we don't seek the counsel of the Lord. But David did that. And this time God said, "No, I want you to wait under the mulberry trees. Just wait over here. And don't move, don't fire a shot, don't do anything until you hear the sound of going or the sound of marching. There'll be a sound in the tops of those trees. It'll sound like soldiers marching." And he gathers his men and they wait. It's kind of an ambush. And you can almost imagine, you know, some young recruit getting, you know, getting an itchy trigger finger or bow finger or whatever, you know. And they're getting closer and it's time to go. And David is like, we're not moving until we hear the sound of going, until we hear the sound of marching. And they waited and they waited and they waited. And finally the sound came. And when they did, they had gave them, God gave them a second victory over the Philistines. David was tested in the same way. The difference is he passed the test. He passed the test. Saul almost made it. What a difference another 30 minutes would have made. Maybe even 10 minutes. I don't know. I don't know how long it was, but it was almost immediately that Saul showed up. I remember hearing a song they sang some years ago, and I don't remember the title of it, but there was a line in there that said, don't give up on the brink of a miracle. Don't give up too soon. The hardest part of faith is the last half hour. I like the words of Roy Lesson. He says this, and I'm through. As you wait on the Lord, you learn to see things from His perspective, move at His pace, and function under His direction. You see the verbs in that sentence? See, move, function. Waiting on the Lord changes how you see things. Mm-hmm. It changes the move of your pace. That has to do with timing. Move at His pace. And you function under His direction. Waiting times are growing times and learning times. As you quiet your heart, you enter His presence. As you sense your weakness, you receive His strength. As you lay down your will, you hear His calling. And when you mount up, when it's finally time to move, to leave, you're being lifted by the wind of the Spirit. And isn't that what Isaiah said? Those who wait upon the Lord shall what? Renew their strength. They will what? Mount up like wings. The wings of an eagle, those updrafts, they just hold up there. They don't even have to fly. They just carry it. You know? I heard a speaker on TV this morning. He's talking about how, he used the illustration of a balloon. I don't know if you heard it, but he said, you blow up a balloon and tie it. You bounce it up in the air and it'll stay in the air. But to keep it in the air, you got to keep whacking it, don't you? It'll come down, you got to keep whacking it. He said, for some people, that's what Sunday morning is. Come to church on Sunday and hit the balloon to get it back up in the air. And they spend their whole life whacking, you know, whacking the balloon. Or to change the figure. Like the guy, remember on the Ed Sullivan show, they had the guy with those little flexible rods and all them plates that they'd twirl. Any of you remember this? And he'd get one, he'd spin one, and he'd move to the second one, he'd spin, and he's watching this one. Because it ain't going to spin forever. And he'd spin this one, and he'd look at that one, he'd run back over here and spin this one. And before you know it, he's just running back and forth, trying to keep all those plates in the air. That describes a lot of folks, doesn't it? And somehow people are proud of all that busyness. They think that's a positive thing. They're out of breath trying to keep the plates from falling. And he said, you know, that's what they do. Sunday morning church is just go to church and, you know, get a boost, get a spiritual fix, whack the balloon, get it back up in the air. He said, but if you really want to change that, change the internal dynamics. Put helium in that balloon. And the healing will keep it up. Now I know every illustration breaks down at some point and eventually the knot in that balloon and the healing will leak. I understand all that. But the point is still made. He says when you mount up, you're being lifted by the wind of the Spirit. When you move ahead, you're sensitive to His timing. Important. When you act, you give yourself only to the things He has asked you to do. That's what it means. That's why I think that waiting, as I've said, is the very essence of trust. And learning to wait, learning to be patient, is one of those, sometimes is a test. It's a mark of our maturity. Let me close with this. I'm pretty sure I've shared this story with you before, but it makes the point. I wrote a blog article about it, and some of you may have read it, but Back when Benita and I first started in the ministry, I had a car that had just worn out, and I needed to get rid of it, but that meant I needed to have another one, you know. And back in those days, in the 70s, the hottest car in America was an Oldsmobile Cutlass. Any of you old enough to remember the Cutlass? It was the top-selling car in the nation. My first car was a Cutlass, and I was looking for a second one. I'd done the Kelley Blue Book work. I knew what they were priced. I'd been to all the dealers and got their prices, which, you know, they were all overpriced. And I was looking for the car because, as an evangelist, I had to move around, and I needed to have a reliable transportation. The old one just didn't fit the bill anymore. And so I found that a neighbor, a guy who'd advertised for sale, you know, himself, not a lot, and I went over and looked at it, and it was a late model. It wasn't a brand new, and it was like 1 year old with just low miles, exceedingly clean. Had it checked out, you know, mechanically to make sure it was okay. The price on that car was about $600 less than the very best price I could find at the dealer. So I agreed, we'll buy this car. So I was waiting on, okay, Ray, this is waiting for a check. The proverbial check in the mail, you know. And that check was coming, it was owed to me, and it was supposed to be in the mail. And that check was going to be my down payment for the bank loan. So, and that was supposed to come, you know, sometime that week. So I gave the man a $100 check as a deposit to hold it. Just hold the car, and when the check comes, I'll go to the bank, make the loan, and I'll pay you off, and we'll be done. So on Monday morning, I went to the mailbox, looked in the mailbox, expecting the check to be there, and you know it wasn't. And it wasn't, just a black hole there. And I thought, well, it's okay. You know, it's still early in the, you know, the post office isn't always so reliable. It'll be here tomorrow. And I went back on Tuesday waiting, and I looked at it, and it was still, there was no check there. And now I'm starting to get a little antsy. I'm starting to get I was about 25 years old, okay? And I was getting a little bit antsy. So on Wednesday, I go to the mailbox. I know it's going to be there that day. It isn't there. And so I realize that at this point, I need to explain things to God a little bit better. He obviously doesn't understand my circumstances, right? So I kind of, listen, let me explain this to you. You know, here's the way this works. This check is necessary for the, you know, I've got to have a down payment to get the loan. And this check is the down payment. If I don't get the down payment, and I have to have it by Friday because in those days banks weren't open on Saturday. And if I don't get the check at least by Friday, I can't make the loan. And if I can't make the loan, I lose the car and I lose the $100. And besides that, by that time I'm whining, you know. I don't have a car to travel and serve you with. I need that car to evangelize. So, Lord, I'm quite confident it'll be there tomorrow. How many of you think that check was there the next day? It wasn't. And finally on Friday when I went, this is the last time, I know it's there. It'll come on time. I opened the mailbox, nothing. And in my immaturity, my youthful inexperience, I just pouted. I got royally ticked off at God, and I told Him so. I just said, you know, I don't understand this. I am there just letting Him have it. I needed this check. What is going on? I don't understand. You know, I'm sitting there fussing at God, and my neighbor drives up, the one who owned the car. And he gets up out of the car, and he walks up, and as I began to apologize, he cuts me short, you know, and he hands me my check back. I said, no, no, no. I'm the one who reneged on the deal. The deposit is yours. He said, no, you don't understand. He said, the ABI, Alabama Bureau of Investigation, just left my house. And I didn't know it. I wasn't aware of it. The car was stolen. I said, what does that mean for you? It means that I'm out the money I paid for the car, and I'm out the car. And if you had bought it from me, you'd be out the money, and you'd be out the car. I looked straight up into heaven and I said, oh. I did. Oh. I think God smiled. I think He smiled. I learned some great lessons that day. I've said this to you 1,000 times, that this is the day I really learned it. God is really smart. Second lesson I learned is that he will always do what is best for his children. Third lesson I learned is he knows exactly what he's doing, even when I think he doesn't. And here's one of the best ones of all. I learned that his grace cannot be conquered by my moods, in spite of the fact that I acted so foolishly. He still blessed me. You see, I did about everything I was supposed to do. I did it right. I had the car checked out. I had a good loan. I knew the price of the book. I mean, everything I knew about that car was true. But there's one thing about it I didn't know, that God knew. He was watching out for me. And I'll tell you this, I have gone back to that lesson in my life many, many times. Many, many times to remember. Now, wait just a minute. There's a difference between perception and reality. You perceive it this way, but that's not the reality. There's more to this. Listen, my life is in his hands. I've entrusted everything to him. So have you. And Paul said, what did he say? He said, I'm persuaded that you are able to keep that which I've committed to your care against that day. The question is, do you believe that? Me and Jack believe it. Do you believe it? Do you believe it? Then learn to trust him and wait on him. Let's stand together.